95% of our brood locations were in something that had been either burned or grazed or some type of disturbance in the last 12 months. Unfortunately, some people get lulled into it. You go to Western Kansas and it's, you know, New Year's and you're hunting pheasants and there's snow, and you go into one of those thick rank CRP fields and the pile of pheasants come out of it. And you're like, this is awesome.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, for 1 month a year. But even for raising pheasant chicks, it's not.
The story of success that it tells, that we can grow quail if we're intentional about it. I think that people like that because, you know, they've seen quail decline their entire career, if they're biologists, or their entire life, if they're hunters, in most places in the country. There are some exceptions, but they like this success story.
Hey everyone, Nick Larson here, host of the Birdshot Podcast, the show that brings you conversations, stories, and traditions from all across the uplands. The Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt and supported by folks just like you via our Patreon community. If you want to stay up to date and not miss any of our upcoming episodes, be sure to subscribe and follow the show in your podcast player or on YouTube, wherever you're listening or watching today. Tap that button for me. Thank you for doing so. And with that said, let's get into today's conversation on the Birdshot Podcast. We are back on the Birdshot Podcast. Welcome back to another episode, everyone. Today we are joined by former guests going back to 2019, Kyle Hedges and Frank Longcarriage. Welcome back to the show, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks. Glad to.
My pleasure. My pleasure. We've been kind of seeing each other at Pheasant Fest the last couple of years and talking about getting you back on the show. And we finally made it happen thanks to a little nudge by Kyle during turkey season. Speaking of that, I know you guys are turkey hunters. Kyle, I saw at least one picture of you from turkey season. I don't know if that was just recently, but turkey season all wrapped up for you guys?
Yeah, ours, the Missouri season ended Mother's Day.
Okay.
Kansas is still open, but I've got a farm in Kansas. It's just a one bird state. It goes till the end of May, which is awful trying to hunt turkeys this late, but I shot a bird over there early as well.
Okay. Frank, what about you? Do you have the turkey bug? I just mentioned to you guys, I watched the Project Upland film that was done with you guys about a year ago. And I know you mentioned in that film that you grew up really a bird hunter, did a little bit of deer hunting and stuff, but what about turkeys? Do they mix in for you?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I was bit by the turkey bug pretty early. And so I've got it, whether I want it or not.
Okay.
You know, I've got it. So I was able to get out and get a bird this year. So that was good.
You're in Missouri too, right, Frank?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm in very far southwest Missouri, near Oklahoma and Arkansas, just a couple hours south of Kyle, southwest a little bit.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. It's our season, our season goes to the end of May too, which is a little bit different story up here in the northern part of the U.S. It's not so bad, but I ended my season, gosh, it might have been the 14th, a couple of weeks ago. I got my one bird here in Minnesota, and I finished right at about the right time, right before it started to get super green and the mosquitoes came out. So I was happy to get that done when I did, and I'm bringing home a new bird dog puppy tomorrow. So I was also just happy to get the turkey season completed and start the puppy preparations.
Yeah. Got to have time for that.
Exactly.
I'll tell you, that late season, I've done it. Well, we greened up really early this year. Normally, you can see through the woods pretty good in Missouri the first week or two of season, and it was already, the brush was greened up. But that really lay this far south, like Kansas going to the end of May. I mean, birds just don't hardly gobble. By the time you get to where you're going, you're wet from the waist down from dew on the grass and stuff. It's just miserable. Too hot.
Yeah.
It's rough.
Yep. That's kind of a sweet spot as far as getting out there when things are happening and stuff. I had some really good hunts this year. Probably got out maybe 6 or 7 times. We got a bird for my son, his first turkeys. That was super exciting. That happened earlier. And then that happened every hunt after that. I realized like how many things went our way for me and the 8-year-old to get his bird. It kind of like, it was a picture perfect hunt, just sort of everything lined up for us. And then I went out and I was in and around birds every day that I went out, but it was not cooperating, henned up, you know, all the things that I'm starting to get acquainted with as I do more and more turkey hunting. But I just kept at it, and eventually got in contact with the right tom at the right time. Actually, a pair of toms. I called them in and almost blew it. I called them in. It was like, so you went out for the morning hunt, and there was a bunch of gobbling. The same group of birds was always gobbling where I'm hunting on this neighbor's property, and they would gobble, but there was at least one really vocal hen with them like every day. And they'd get down out of the tree and wanted nothing to do with me. So I kind of set up on them in the way that I could that day, because there was the only thing gobbling. I just was like, I want to hear a bird gobbling somewhere else, you know, try to find that lone tom, but I never did. So I set up on them and I only sat there for about an hour, and it just seemed like it was going to be the same pattern. They get down, they move across this field, and they're like out of where I can get at them. So I picked up, moved, and made an early move at like an hour after sunrise, and got to the point of this little oak knob that I've sat on before. And nothing happened for like 2 hours. All the gobbling shut down. And maybe about an hour into that, hour and a half, I heard one kind of gobble below me, called to it, didn't really get a response. This is like 8:30 in the morning or something. And didn't hear anything. And then about 9:30, I heard that same gobble, and he's down below me, and I called and I got him to respond. So I think I let it sit for a little while, maybe 10, 15 minutes later, kind of checked him, did a call, got a gobble again, clearly moving, like coming around behind me. So now I'm pretty excited. And the way that this thing set up, there was a trail that kind of went, I was looking at a trail. The bird was coming around behind me and below me. This is the second time I've done this, when I've had a turkey gobbling behind me and I don't turn around, because I'm set up facing one way, and like, I'm like, this would be perfect if he just comes in like this. Well, turkeys don't always do what you want them to do, right?
Almost never.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's this trail that comes up and kind of, the bird would be coming from my right to left, and I didn't really want to lose visibility on that. So I was reluctant to shift to my left, which is what I should have done. And these birds, what I didn't realize is I'm sitting up on top of a little oak knob. There was one trail that came up from the bottom, which I knew about. There was another one that actually came up right on my left shoulder, and it was hidden by some big root balls. There were some big spruce trees up here tipped over. I had no idea it was there. I set up in this spot and just didn't look and notice that. And so I'm sitting there. The birds did not gobble a lot. I only knew that they were kind of moving in my direction. So there was a possibility that this could go my way. Well, then I got that. Was that drumming? Am I hearing drumming? Kind of thinking it. And then I hear it again, and I'm about like a 90%, like, I'm pretty sure that's drumming. By the time I heard the spit and drum, where I was like, oh yeah, that's a bird, I like strained my eyes and my neck as far as I could to the left, and I see two big red heads just like standing there. They couldn't have been more than 15 yards away. Had I shifted earlier or known about that trail, it would have been game over right then and there, but I couldn't move at that point. So I was straining to the left, and like I couldn't turn my eyes further any further to the left without like blacking out. Like my vision was going blurry. I just kind of had to wait them out, and they start, one of them popped into strut. And so I was like, okay, I'm not totally busted yet. And they were sort of looking up over periscoping up on top. I had a decoy up there, which I think they could see it. So I was still thinking there was a chance that they might just pop all the way up over the top and it would have been an easy shot. But what ended up happening is one of the birds disappeared. I lost track of them in my blurry vision looking to the left. And the other one, he got nervous and just started kind of head up, but he didn't drop off the slope that I was on. He just started walking away from me. And so as he was kind of going behind a tree here and there, I was able to make enough of a move, get my gun up, and I took the first chance I got and I dropped him. But just every encounter is a little bit different. You guys know this better than me, but it was, I was very happy to get it done, but I almost blew it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that classic mid-morning.
My daughters make fun of me because I don't know how many hunts I've said, oh, he'll come right up here, right up this trail. And then they loop around and then, yep, you know, we don't kill the bird, or maybe they do kill the bird. And apparently I always say, I can't believe he did that. Why wouldn't he just use his trail? And they're like, yep, he never does what you say he's going to do. They always do something different. Like, yeah, I guess I should just start expecting it. They never take the easiest route that doesn't seem. They always got to wander around and go through some crap. You can't see them. It makes it exciting.
I'm glad I'm not the only one, because that, you know, I think that way too. Like, you know that they use these trails, like you'll see them on trail camera photos or whatever, and you'll see tracks and droppings. So you know that they use it, but when a turkey's coming in, like, it doesn't really care where it goes. Or the birds that I drew them up to this top, I'm sure they use this trail all the time. I didn't know that trail was there. Had I known, I maybe would have done a little dip. I probably would have seen them, got glimpses of them down below coming up. I mean, I could have been so ready for these birds, but lesson learned. I would definitely go back to that spot. It's a really good spot to set up. But to your point, Frank, it was a good confidence booster for me, because I've been in this situation where on my own turkey hunting, like I'll have most of my success is that kind of right off the roost, you get the right bird on the right day and he wants to play the game, kind of comes right in. But it's after that initial excitement and gobbling, like then what do you go do? And you hear about, oh, you know, 9:30, 10:30, it's, you know, they'll start gobbling again, and it's a good time to get one going. Well, this was like to a T. That's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
These birds were doing whatever. I think they were in a field down below me. And then, you know, he gobbled. They probably heard my calling every 15, 20 minutes for an hour and just eventually decided to come check it out. And that's what they did. The funny thing was, actually, these two birds came up and I had dropped the one. And then as I was like sort of in the post-hunt celebration, just kind of checking out the bird and stuff, this other bird, he just dropped back down the hill, went right over to another little opening down below. It's like a little kind of a wildlife opening. And he just hammered, just started gobbling for like 15, 20 minutes. So like they were determined to just like go to a little strut zone mid-morning, gobble, pick up another hen, do whatever. But I noted that on my way out. I was like, okay, there's a mid-morning strut zone. I already knew that spot was there, but to see that or hear that Tom go down there and do that, it was a good confidence booster for the mid-morning hunt after the sunrise stuff.
Well, good, because I've killed a lot of birds just sitting in one spot and calling periodically and nodding off, you know, that whole mid-morning lull kind of hits, and then all of a sudden one, you know, gobbles and you about bust your eardrums out, or he gobbles far enough away that you can get ready, and it happens more frequently than you would think. I kind of like that mid-morning, you know, seems like we're always so hemmed up here. And I mean, that's the story everywhere I've hunted.
Yeah.
But, you know, I kind of like that. Okay, let's things settle down. I've got real confidence in that now. So Yeah, I'm glad it worked out for you.
Yeah. Yep. It was a fun one. I'm definitely looking forward to next season already, fresh off the hunt, but as you know, we've got lots of fun to have before next turkey season.
Yep.
I will ask you this. This is something, so quail and turkeys. We're going to transition. We're going to talk about quail today, not so much turkeys, but you guys, I would be surprised if you weren't aware of the sort of the questioning around, like, are turkeys bad for grouse? Like in the grouse range, like where I'm hunting, I grew up deer hunting in this area when I was a kid. There was no turkeys around. I mean, I won't say there was none, but I don't think there were. I was never sitting in the deer stand and saw a turkey. Now I'm turkey hunting right there, and there's turkeys all over the place. And so we've had this migration or advancement, I don't even know what you want to call it, of turkeys kind of moving into these northern forests. And it's an easy correlation, like people saying there's not as many grouse as there used to be, there's more turkeys now. I think the turkeys are eating the grouse eggs or chicks or whatever. I've working for the Ruffed Grouse Society, that came up all the time, and my understanding is, like, turkeys and grouse have overlapped in certain areas for a long time. Turkeys are pretty opportunistic feeders. Might they eat a grouse egg if they come across it? Yeah. But are they specifically predating and selecting on it? I don't know. But does that same conversation come up in the quail world? Because I would imagine the overlap there is, like, way more ubiquitous.
For 40 years, people have been blaming the quail decline on turkeys in the Midwest. Yes. We don't hear it near like we used to, but in the 90s and early 2000s when turkeys were just exploding. Oh yeah.
Yep.
Nobody's bothering to think, well, those pastures, the scrubby pastures that you used to shoot quail in are now grown up into locust, hedge, cedar forests. So they're not quail habitat anymore, but turkeys will still use it.
Yeah.
You know, nobody wanted to discuss that part of it. It was just, well, there's more turkeys and less quail. They must be eating the quail.
Yeah.
Frank, well, there was one research project that threw merit to this. Remember that?
Oh, vaguely. I'm not remembering it too well.
It was back, like, somebody dug around and found some paper from, I don't remember who had written it, but documented turkey destroying a quail nest, like, in the 60s or something.
Yeah.
And so then some people started running. Well, see, they, well, no. I mean, like, literally, you know, they bumble across one or stomped on one or who knows, but.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's not causation. I always told people if they were hunting quail nests, if they were hunting baby quail, then we wouldn't have all the turkeys, right? Because there wasn't enough quail to sustain the turkey population.
Right, yeah, sure.
They would starve. Yeah. Dr. James Martin from Georgia, he's done a ton of quail work. He says, look, I've seen a turkey randomly take a quail chick, said, but I've seen him take a bullfrog, or I've seen him take a snake, or any of these other critters that they see on the landscape that runs by and that's the size of something they can eat, they grab it. It's opportunistic, like you mentioned with the grouse. And it's nothing more than that, really. It's a habitat issue, which I'm sure we'll explore, but it's something, like Kyle mentioned, we've heard for a long, long time in the quail world.
Yeah. Yeah, I was curious if that was a thing or a topic at all, because it's quite common here, especially, I mean, every year, like, I feel like I see turkeys in an area that, like, I never have growing up, and it's just like, how do they, I don't know how they can make it through the winters up here when there's deep snow, and that, you know, they're not snow roosting like grouse. Like, I'm anthropomorphizing, but I just think about a 40 below zero night, and I think about a turkey sitting up in a big red pine tree, like, what the heck is he doing down there? And then he hops down in the day, and there's 2 feet of snow on the ground. Like, I think they flock up, and people will take pictures of them out on frozen lakes, and they do what they can. But I don't know. It's interesting. Where I turkey hunt, you know, I'm sitting there, I'm listening to turkeys gobbling, and I hear grouse drumming all day long. So, I mean, they're in the same woods. They're overlapping. And is there some grouse loss happening? Likely so, but there's lots of grouse and there's lots of turkeys, and it's such a new, strange thing, I think, for a lot of people that live up here.
We actually, Frank and I both went to Wisconsin trapping some grouse for a reintroduction project down here.
I remember that.
And in the cafe eating breakfast in the morning, you know, it was when turkeys were first really exploding on the scene.
Yep.
And people were like, you take them turkeys back to Missouri with you. They're eating all our grouse. We didn't argue with them. It was just funny to hear, you know, it was the same thing, and it just spread north.
Yeah.
You know, decades later. We even get I really get a kick out of this. It's always my brother or brother-in-law or somebody, but my brother-in-law shot a turkey and its crop was just full of baby quail. Well, that's interesting in Missouri, because our season closes on Mother's Day for turkey hunting. And the earliest, we've monitored 500 nests in our research project, and the earliest hatch we ever had was Memorial Day. Your brother-in-law is a poacher if he's shooting turkeys that are packed full of
eggs.
Baby quail chicks. He's shooting them in June or July. Like, this doesn't add up. But
Yeah. I've heard some extreme things as well. And again, there's usually somewhere in between there. But
yeah.
So you guys mentioned you were both part of, not today, but on the film that I rewatched this morning. You guys were part of a huge 5-year quail study. When was that study done?
It was done from 2014 to 2018. Well, we had a couple of years of pilot data. So we'd actually been doing it since 2012 to 2018, but really we analyzed 2014 through 2018.
Okay. So that was right after, or right before our last interview. So I'm certain we discussed it at the time, but, you know, fast forward to 2026, one of the things you mentioned was that was one of the largest, if not the largest, data sets on quail, on nesting habitat at the time. What have you guys been up to since? I guess this stuff getting at, Frank.
Yeah. What we've been up to since is just trying to spread the word. So we've got this data that we think is really compelling, and we've got it out there in various print forms, whether it's scientific journals or popular articles that we've written, podcasts that we've done, films that we've been a part of, just trying to get the word out there, speaking engagements that we've done from North Carolina to Nebraska, and a lot of places in between, really trying to get this word out. And the reason that we've been able successfully to have all of these venues open to us is that the research is very compelling, and it tells an important story that really hasn't been told, I'd say in the upper or the Midwest where we're at, where the quail decline has been very steep. And so we've been trying to get the word out there, and it's been very successful. People have invited us to do a lot of different things, and I think it's because the quality of the data that we've been able to collect and the story of success that it tells, that we can grow quail if we're intentional about it. And I think that people like that because, you know, they've seen quail decline their entire career, if they're biologists, or their entire life, if they're hunters in most places in the country. There are some exceptions, but, you know, they like this success story. So I think that's what we've been doing in the meantime.
Yep. Now I know one of the things that you guys talked about and regular listeners of the show might recall my conversation with Jeff Hodges last year, conserving quail habitat. We talked a lot about like grazing, working landscapes, quail habitat, and how that stuff all aligns, which is something that Kyle, you punctuated, I think, in the film was, you know, in order to be successful, you have to figure out where quail habitat and working landscapes align. So could you talk about like maybe the key sort of realizations or takeaways from that study, and then how that applies to the modern landscape, and what folks can take away from that?
Yeah, and this is the basic premise, is it goes back to usable space. So what we found out, just a super quick recap of this study, you know, we were on public lands, we were managing quail with what we call the old dairy farm system, right? A food plot with a grass strip, with a shrub strip, and then a food plot, right? Really broken up landscape. And back when there were dairy farms everywhere, there was quail everywhere, back in the 40s, 50s, 60s. But the landscape changed all around our public lands. So that model doesn't work as well. You can produce some quail, don't get me wrong. But it does not work as well when it's just being done on 1,000 acres or 2,000 acres or 500 acres. When the whole county was broken up like that, and of course you had dirtier farming back then, you didn't have, you know, clean, super clean crop fields, all that. Mm-hmm. Didn't have introduced grasses like fescue way back then. You had native grasses. So our study revealed that, you know, these grassland landscapes managed with fire and cattle were far more productive for quail. 13% higher nest success in those landscapes versus the broken up dairy farm model. Breeding season survival was 8% higher. So you got more birds making it to the end of breeding season. And those nests are more successful in that grassland system. And there was a couple more eggs in every nest on average in the grassland system versus the... So everything's point, you know, this starts getting exponential at some point. Yeah. And it starts pointing to, hey, what's going on here? Well, it's all about usable space. We are maximizing usable space in these grassland landscapes, a term that Fred Guthrie coined back in the 90s. People just didn't listen like they should have, including us. And you keep learning and you reflect back and say, oh, yeah, I see what he was talking about. So these grasslands were managing with fire and grazing. Well, in Missouri East... Well, kind of eastern Kansas and east quail range, we get too much rain, right? So in Texas, western Oklahoma, they need rain to grow quail. Droughts, they don't have any habitat. It's just too bare. We're on the opposite end of the spectrum. All the way through Kentucky, Tennessee, all the way down to Florida, we get too much rain. We're 45 plus inches a year. So our habitat gets too thick. And we found out real quick, We were radio collaring chicks as well. We were following broods around. That they, 95% of our brood locations were in something that had been either burned or grazed or some type of disturbance in the last 12 months.
Mm.
So back to Frank's comment about being intentional. If you're not doing some disturbance pretty regularly, that idle native grass field, that CRP look that we all know that we pheasant hunt through in western Kansas, that's not producing quail. The chicks can't get through. It's too thick. You know, maybe they're just skirting the very edges. They might nest in there, but as soon as they hatch, they're in trouble. So how, you know, we're looking at our data and saying, okay, this is working. Well, how can we manipulate landscapes to benefit this? Well, in Missouri, 93% of the land is privately owned. Kansas is even higher. You know, we're not like Utah, some of these western states that have real high public land.
Yep.
So grazing and fire, that's where we're going to make the biggest difference. Crop prices, commodity prices are too high. We're not going to get, in general, massive acres to be withdrawn from row cropping and turned into quail habitat. That's just not realistic. People need to pay the bills. So how can we get on those grazing operations, get some more native grasses restored, you know, get away from some of the fescue, at least part of their farm, And then the cows and the quail can coexist quite well. In fact, we prove that disturbance can be ideal
for
raising quail.
Did you say 90 or 95% of the nests were where there was a disturbance within the last year?
The brood rearing.
Okay.
95% was in some type of disturbance within the last 12 months. So
wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. That's eye opening.
Yeah. Yeah. So grazing and fire, those are the two main disturbance types. Kind of like up here, we talk about rough grouse, we talk about, you know, fire, but we don't really allow that to happen for obvious reasons. So it's forestry and cutting, and that same disturbance, a similar mechanism there that grouse hunters would be able to relate with. Those two disturbances, how able are they to be applied on the landscape? Is there, you know, prescribed burning is, I would imagine, maybe more palatable there, but are there big barriers to getting more grazing, getting more prescribed burning? Is it more about like just getting enough of it done on a large amount of landscape?
Well, I think you're right about prescribed fire being more palatable here for sure. Eastern Kansas and east, and then southeast, of course, you get down to the quail plantations, and that's what they use is prescribed fire. On an every other year basis and raise a ton of quail with some other mechanisms involved there too. But, you know, first we've got to create, it goes back to that usable space that Kyle talked about. First, we've got to create that early successional herbaceous habitat on the ground first before we can even burn it. Places where we have it, we can certainly burn it, or places where we could restore it, we can certainly burn it and get it back, like in very, very early successional forests or shrubby fields or brushy fields like that. We can get it back to quail friendly pretty quickly with fire and some tree cutting. But where we don't have it is where we run into some big problems, and that's where working landscapes come in and how in convincing landowners to establish these quail friendly forages on their property as a part of their operation and as a profitable part of their operation, not just as a part of their operation where they get a feeling of I'm doing something good for quail. No, we want them to be profitable. Yeah. We want them to pay the bills, and having native grasses as a part of their operation can certainly be profitable. We've shown that through various studies, through various economic analyses that it can be profitable. It's convincing those, and you know, the barriers are, you know, folks just, you know, have been generations growing up raising their cattle on brome or fescue or some other introduced forages. So you try to bring something new in, even though it's native, even though it was there, you know, historically and was the historic forage of bison and elk, it's still new to them. And so convincing them and convincing them that it can be profitable is one of the barriers. And also there's some loss of production when you put it in the first year, you're going to lose a little bit of forage production from that particular pasture. So you've got to figure out ways around that, but science has been able to do that, and we've been able to figure out ways to sort of mitigate that. But that's what we're working on now is trying to convince landowners. We've got different initiatives that, you know, through different state and federal government programs to help farmers do that. But that's what we're working on now is trying to get over some of those barriers to production.
Yeah, so I'm hearing change is hard, and if there's enough friction, it's a lot easier just to keep doing what you've been doing rather than try something new.
Right. Yes. Yep. I think that's in a lot of things.
In our career,
Yes. Yeah.
In our career, Frank and I have never seen the amount of money and attention towards reestablishing native forages. We've been talking about this for decades, and it's finally hit with a bunch of different money sources. National Bob White is in on it. There's state and federal cost shares that's in on it. Drought, right? Fescue doesn't perform well in drought years. We've had some pretty significant droughts across Missouri and Arkansas and some other states. So the natives do great in drought. They were accustomed to dry, you know, hot, dry July and August. And they, Indian grass and big bluestem, they keep growing. So we've been some very positive progress, more than we've ever seen in our career in that regard. So it's been a good time to see those initiatives taking hold and people grabbing on. And there, I want to mention one other thing. You ask about disturbances. So, you know, on the working lands, that's where we need to get to. But in general, CRP acres or whatever, you know, there's some other techniques too that work, whether it's strip light disking, strip disking, some chemical applications where we can thin that grass back down, not just fire alone. Places where you are not allowed to graze, there's some other techniques that we can use mechanically or chemically to make it more appropriate for raising quail, you know, get more weeds, more forbs, whatever you want to call them. That's what we need for that brood rearing. So,
What, you mentioned the like old CRP field that's sitting there. It might look good, but it's maybe not getting utilized. Is there a, do you have a handle on like how much of it is sitting there just waiting to be waiting for a disturbance? Is there a huge amount of it that's just not being utilized properly, or, you know, what is the opportunity level, I guess, is what I'm asking.
I would guess that unfortunately it's well above 80%. Most CRP is right now most of my farm in Kansas is in CRP. Of course, I'm burning regularly. I'm doing all kinds of stuff, but the requirements now are down to one burn in a 10-year contract. So for game birds, that's just not cut.
Like the bare minimum is not going to cut it.
No. Right. So unfortunately, some people get lulled into it. You go to Western Kansas and it's, you know, New Year's and you're hunting pheasants and there's snow and you go into one of those thick rank CRP fields and the pile of pheasants come out of it. And you're like, this is awesome.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, for 1 month a year. But even for raising pheasant chicks, it's not. It could be better. We don't need it all to be in that state. So that's the rub. And there's plenty of effort going into that as well to, again, getting the word out. Like, hey, we've got data to show this is what we need to do.
What would be a good prescription if, you know, if the bare minimum is, you know, federally mandated CRP, this is kind of out of my, you know, I don't own a farm and I don't have stuff in CRP, but if they say you got to do it once every 10 years, what would be like the 80-20 huge step in the right direction? Twice in 10 years, once every 3 years, like what's the prescription?
Well, I think the prescription is, if allowed, of course, if it's in CRP, then there may be some things that aren't allowed, but let's just talk about in a perfect world, if, you know, what we've found and what they're finding in Georgia is, in Florida, is about every other year to maximize quail. Now, that may be too much on an individual landowner to do, or it might be too much for their production, or, you know, just getting it all done. But every other year would be maximizing, like Kyle said, 95% of our broods were in something that were grazed or burned within the last 12 months. But once out of every 3 years is generally what we try for. And generally we can still have good success once every 3 years. That allows you to get around the farm in a reasonable amount of time and still have good quail production out of that. And we do that a lot of times on state ground is how we manage is a lot of times on a 3-year basis.
Okay. Yeah, I guess your study kind of shows, like, if you could do it once a year or have a patch burned every year, like within a certain distance, that would be ideal. But obviously something is better than nothing. So once every 3 years is definitely better than once every 10 years.
Yeah. In a perfect world, the Southeast do a lot of checkerboard. You would have small units,
sure,
and you would burn this checkerboard, half of them. The next year you'd burn the other half and you just rotate. My farm that's mostly CRP in Kansas and some timber. I mean, I've split all my CRP fields in half. I'm on them every other year, 50%, burn half of it one year, the other half of them next year. And for turkeys and quail and deer as well, you know, having thick, rank Indian grass and big blue stem, well, they might lay down out there, but there's no forage. So if I can maintain more forbs, I've got deer eating ragweed. I've got deer eating wild bergamot. I've got, you know, whatever's out there. They're eating on those forbs. So it's good for all the species, not just quail and turkey chicks.
Do you hunt all three species on your farm, or do they become pets of a sort?
Oh, no. It's all for...
Okay.
It's all for sport.
Yeah, I love it. Prescribed burn, and I'm asking some of these questions because I do know that we have there's listeners over there out here that have land and farms. I'm thinking of one person in particular that's got he's got land in Kansas. So I mean, he's done some habitat work for quail. A prescribed burn, is that one thing you mentioned, Kyle, is like incentives, right? You try to align the incentives, because otherwise it is hard to get people. There are people out there that do things out of the goodness of their heart because they have the means to do so, but that's not the case for everyone. Is a prescribed burn, is that like a out-of-pocket cost for the landowner, or is there a way to get that done that is more incentivized?
Kyle, I'll let you handle that one.
Okay. I was waiting for you.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yes, there is cost share programs. We have state cost share that'll help pay for burning. And of course, those funds are limited, so it's prioritized certain parts of the state. Most states have some level of state cost share. There's federal programs that, if you're enrolled in, will also help pay for burning. But yeah, there's a lot of people doing it out of pocket. But it's really not that expensive if you're applying it yourself. It's just some time. You need some equipment. Actually, for listeners that hopefully you read the online articles too, Frank and I put together a three or four part prescribed burn series. I think came out in February. So look those up online on Project Eplin. But anyway, there's several different opportunities to get some funding to help it. You know, if in the cattle world, you know, parts of Kansas, they're burning because it increases their weight gains on their cattle. So there's a financial incentive to do it anyway. So in the right context, it benefits the landowner regardless. Obviously, if you're a diehard bird hunter, you're going to do it. I'm doing it out of pocket on my place because I want to help the wildlife. I'm willing to cost myself some funds. So there's all those different scenarios. There's burn contractors out there,
right,
you know, that people will hire. A lot of people are scared of fire, kind of has a bad rap. You see on TV, you know, big wildfires in California burning everything up. So fire's bad. Well, no, fire was a native or a natural disturbance for thousands of years here. And we removed that natural disturbance. It's important to keep that on the landscape, especially in native habitats, native plants. They rely on fire. The quail, bobwhite quail, is called the fire bird. Well, we can't be successful, successful on quail without fire somewhere in the system.
Getting people to understand that fire is a good thing is, you know, that's one thing. And like the person listening to this podcast is probably aware of that, more so than average citizen. But then to take that a step further and to think I'm going to go take a torch and start some stuff on fire, like a DIY, like that's next level there, Kyle.
Yeah. And fortunately, you know, a lot of states offer, the state Fish and Game Agency offers prescribed burn workshops to train landowners. We do those. Missouri offers those. There's been a recognition by Fish and Game agencies, the lack of fire. How can we increase fire? We know we need to do it to help lots of different wildlife. So there's all these other opportunities beyond just financial incentives. So trainings are out there. Some rural fire departments, some places, you can pay them and they'll come burn. They use it as a training for their, you know, firemen and women.
Sure.
Then they'll come burn your property and you pay them a little bit, a couple hundred bucks. So there's all kinds of these prescribed burn associations have been started all across the country where it's a group of landowners. Just they get together, they'll get a grant and get some equipment in a trailer. And it's, hey, you know, let's all agree to help each other. I've got a couple burns on my farm. So we'll go help Bill, but then, you know, when it's time to help Joe, we're all in to help Joe too. And Phil, and you just, right? Neighbors start helping each other, and pretty soon, hey, I can put together a burn crew. I'm not out here trying to do this by myself. So it's moving in the right direction, but change takes a while. And you got to build that culture. It's an entire culture. You have to have a fire culture. The Flint Hills of Kansas have had that fire culture for a long time. But a lot of the rest of the country, it takes a while to get there.
Yeah. I am aware of, like, I know there's like prairie restoration businesses. You hear those around, and I would think they would do like native plantings, also burns. That does seem to be cropping up more and more.
Yeah, there's a lot of interest, as Kyle mentioned earlier, in restoring native grasslands for a host of reasons, whether it's you know, air quality, water quality, or wildlife. And so, yeah, they're popping up. One of the big problems has been securing enough seed, but I think we've kind of got over most of that hump. But yeah, restoring grasslands is a big thing now in the conservation world, and that just trickles down to help all these critters that need grasslands. And then once you get grasslands established, you can't just, you know, walk away. You've got to come back and you've got to put that prescribed fire on the ground on a rotational basis, and you've got to work at it to make it successful. But we're gratified to see that at the ends of our careers, as we've, I guess we sort of the end of our careers, that we're seeing these grasslands getting more and more attention.
Yeah. You know, not the end, just the next chapter, right, Frank?
Just the next chapter, yeah. Yeah.
Pollinators is another example. There's been all kinds of money for pollinator plantings all over the country. And they're, you know, targeting our bee population has declined, of course, because of herbicide, all kinds of reasons, habitat loss, monarchs, all these things. Well, I can guarantee you there's been a lot of quail habitat put in for people in the name of pollinators that the landowner may not care in a bit if there was ever a butterfly on their property. But the funding was there, and quail love pollinator planting. So you use whatever tools you have to get the habitat on the ground. And then they start saying, wow, this is really pretty. And wow, it's funny when the people that aren't very interested in the pollinator, the actual butterflies themselves, but they plant that stuff, and pretty soon you can't help but grow on you. I mean, who doesn't, you know, who gets mad at a butterfly? So you're out there seeing all these different species, and pretty soon they're taking pictures, and their interest peaks.
I haven't always been, not that I had a dislike for butterflies or anything, but I definitely look at them differently now just in doing this and having these kinds of conversations over the years. And I'm obviously aware of pollinator habitat. My guess would have been there's big alignment there, and game bird habitat, obviously Pheasants Forever is doing a lot of stuff in that space. But I see butterfly and wildflowers. Like I have a whole new appreciation for them. I would put in a couple of little sort of wild, native wildflower strips in my backyard here in Minnesota. It's just cool.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. Yeah. It's really taken off. The native plant movement is really taken off. So that's good to see.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Very much so. Okay. So let's transition to quail hunting a little bit with two guys that I think would be safe to say are sort of quail habitat experts. In the film, the Project Upland film, like it's very, you know, there's like, it's late, it was January, everything's kind of dull and gray and brown, but it looked birdy. Like, but talk to me about what are you moving through? What is the waist high shrubbery that you're moving through? And what am I seeing for habitat in that film?
Well, we were hunting
specifically in that.
Oh, go ahead, Kyle. Yeah, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's okay. I'll give you part of the two. We got a delay going here. Some in that specific film, that was Shinnery Oak. So we were in western Oklahoma. But
okay,
it's the same thing could have been shot in Kansas, and it's going to be wild plum thickets, right?
Okay.
In Missouri, it's some wild plums, going to be lots of dogwood and sumac thickets. Anything that gives that brushy escape cover, that proper height, the woody escape cover is what we're looking for. So you can go down, you know, it'll be maybe young mesquite in parts of Texas. It just depends on where you're at. It'll be palmetto and different stuff, you know, down in Florida. It's all functions the same. Quail are so fascinating because they live in all across these different states, and some of the habitat doesn't look anything alike it, but it's all about this right structure.
Yeah.
They need some grass, they need a bunch of forbs, they need some bare ground, and they need some type of escape cover. And in most cases, that's some type of woody shrubby cover.
Yeah.
Sounds a lot like grouse in that, you know, they rough grouse have a super wide range and it doesn't look the same everywhere, but it has a similar structure to it. Go ahead, Frank.
Yeah. That's one of the things that I failed to mention in sufficiently that I think we want to is, you know, we talk about these native grasses and forbs and trying to get them established on the landscape. And that's really critical. But to really have a maximized quail population, you've got to have some forb, some woody cover component, some brushy shrubby component that's, you know, 10 to 20% of the landscape. And we usually, a lot of times, don't worry about that because we're fighting brush and shrub takeover so much as a part of what we're doing with our management that we usually don't worry about shrub cover, you know, but there are places where there is a lack of shrubby cover. And there'll be quail around, but to maximize it, it's got to have that shrubby cover. So when Kyle talked about wild plum in Kansas or Shinnery Oak in Oklahoma, that's where you got to start thinking when you want to hunt. You know, you got to think, well, I'm going to hunt grasslands. These guys tell me grasslands are productive. Well, if there's no shrub component there, you're pretty much hunting prairie chicken country, which is fine. You know, I love chickens, but you know, it's not quail.
Yeah. What about, we didn't really talk about invasive species. Like I'm thinking like buckthorn and eastern red cedar. Like, is that are those a factor at all when it comes to quail habitat, encroaching on quail habitat, Frank?
Yeah. Eastern red cedar has been a real bugaboo for quail. That and say Osage Orange and Hedge. And what happens is, they start to take over a field and they're small and they don't look like a problem. And the next thing you know, if you've not addressed them, then you've got essentially a forest of eastern red cedar that is good for really no no species. I mean, there may be a few critters that use it for thermal protection, but certainly our native wildlife or native bird species, game bird species, don't use it. And there's, you know, autumn olive can do the same thing. But in terms of covering vast areas, you nailed it with eastern red cedar. We usually don't have a problem with buckthorn down here, but we do have a problem with hedge, Osage orange, and eastern red cedar can be a real issue.
Now, there's a flip side to that, and he's right. I mean, I think we've got an article we're going to put together for Project Eplin about cedar invasion, and you know, western Nebraska. There's lots of grasslands all across Missouri that have been lost to cedar invasion. On the flip side of that, you know, farm country of western Kansas, shelter belts, sometimes that is the only woody cover around. So the there's a cedar shelter belt running down the side of a CRP field, the crop field on one side, CRP field on the other side, and there's a cedar shelter belt running down the middle of it. Well, that may be the only woody cover around, and there'll be a covey of quail in that almost every time. So there is utilization in those specific instances, but that widespread cedar encroachment ends up being a disaster. So in a controlled environment, they have their functionality.
Yeah. Yeah, I see a similar thing with buckthorn up here, especially around the city. We have a lot of it in the city forests, and it's like there's a structure to it. I mean, it's thick, nasty cover, and there will be grouse and woodcock in and around it, but from a forest composition perspective, I don't really like to see it, but there will be utilization, as you said, Kyle.
Yeah.
Would you describe quail as kind of like edge birds in the way that some grouse hunters talk about them? Like you're moving through the wild plum or the shrub hide grass, but you're trying to stay on the edge of the oaks or the escape cover, right? Like what I'm hearing is like a bird hunter talking to me. You're paying attention to where the birds are, where they want to go, trying to be on the edge of that transition. Would you describe them that way, Kyle?
Yeah. I mean, typically we're looking for that. You know, they're going to spend they're going to roost in some herbaceous cover, right? Typically grassy type area. And first thing in the morning, unless it's super cold, they're going to break the roost and they're going to feed. So that's either going to be crop, waste grain, or if you're in a big open grassland type landscape, that's going to be on native seeds, forbs. So you want those kind of weedy areas. They're going to spend most of the day in a thicket somewhere in that brushy cover, shrubby cover. And then late afternoon, they're going to have another feed, then they're going to go to roost. So the bulk of the day, this depends on the time of the day, but the bulk of the day, you want to be somewhere near that shrubby cover. You know, they're not normally flying. They will on occasion, but they're not normally flying from their roost site 300 yards to go feed and then flying. They're not doing like a pheasant might. They're walking somewhere, feed, then they're walking to a thicket to hang out all day to hide from hawks, process the food they have. So we're usually, basically going thicket to thicket for the most part, covering the grass and forbs in between and, you know, hoping the dogs do their job because you can't cover all of it. And the dogs are lacing back and forth and but a lot of edge, and some of that is micro edge. I mean, that you don't even really think about. There may be a little thicker grass over here and a little thinner where some cows graze, but it's weedier, maybe ragweed or something, which quail love to eat the seeds of from ragweed. Those transitions are an edge. It's not an edge like we think of grass to forest, but it's still an edge, weeds to grass. So any of that is things to look for sure.
Yeah. That reminds me, we didn't really talk about this, but in when you did your big study, you know, you hear a lot of people talk about predators, nest plunderers, that sort of thing. Did your study reveal anything of note regarding, imagine avian predators are probably the number one for quail, but you guys correct me if I'm wrong, but any insights on predation Does it all come back to with the right habitat, predation doesn't matter, or is it not as simple as that, Frank?
Yeah, I would think that the most of it, especially, and it's kind of seasonal, but the biggest, single predator would be avian predators like sharp-shinned hawks, Cooper's hawks, things like that. Now, that's especially seen during the hawk migration in the wintertime when we get hawks from up your way to come down to the overwinter. Mm-hmm. Here, we see a spike in adult mortality. Where predators really play a big role is in the nesting cycle, whether it's in the nest where snakes can take a few eggs, or when you're talking about after they've hatched and they're vulnerable then. But we did tie a little bit of predator stuff in when we actually radio collared some raccoons to see how they moved across these landscapes that were more broken up in the dairy farm model versus these grassland models or grassland areas. And what we found is there were fewer nest predators in general in the grasslands, which makes sense because there's less habitat for them to be in. There's less trees. Raccoons and possums are what we're talking about here. And so there's less trees for them to den in and raise their young. Also, they covered the landscape much more differently in these areas. The raccoons that we collared were very reluctant to travel out into the grasslands at all. They would travel out there, 40 to 50 meters, and that was about it, because they knew that they would run into their predators, which would be coyotes in that case. On the more broken up landscapes, there were hiding places throughout the landscape, whether it was trees across the landscape that they could run and jump into if they run into a predator, or an old dozer pile, or a real rock pile, or just stuff you see, trashy areas you see around farms, or old farm sites and stuff like that, where they can hide. They would cover a lot more of the dissected model, which means that it put a lot more nests in the areas in which they covered on the dissected model versus the grassland model. They covered a lot. They covered their propensity to at least run into a nest was much more reduced on the grassland areas because they just rarely went out there. They stayed along the edges. Maybe an adult would go out and go to a pond and hunt for crayfish, but majority of the time they stayed around road edges, ditch edges. They were pretty reluctant to go out in the grasslands.
That sounds definitely not insignificant. That's a kind of a neat observation.
Well, yeah, which probably plays a role in that 13% higher nest success that we saw on the grasslands.
Sure.
It's led us to also prescribe removing those scattered trees. If you're all in for quail and you've got just, an old scrubby tree row that isn't serving any shrubby cover, right? You've just got seven trees scattered across the pasture. Well, that is escape cover for a raccoon. So get rid of those seven trees. Quail don't need those seven trees. You want plum thickets. You want dogwood thickets. You don't need random trees that a coon can den in or climb or whatever. Or their hawk perches. It just goes on and on and on.
Well, if listeners were going to take away one thing, whether they are a landowner, they know a landowner, what would you want them to take away or at least know about? And if they have questions and want to get in contact with you, how could they do that, Kyle?
The takeaway for me would be not just quail wise, any game bird We've reached a point, it's not accidental for most of this. We need to be deliberate. So if you care about it and you really want to make a difference, and it's whether it's your own land, it's someplace you hunt, let's say you don't have any land, you only hunt on public land. Well, there's opportunities. There's Habitat Work Days on public land. Join an organization that contributes to habitat management. There's opportunities to help, but whether you're trying to grow sage grouse, rough grouse, prairie chickens, quail, pheasants, it all takes deliberate action and it all costs time and money to make habitat. So get involved somehow, any way you can, and be deliberate about improving habitat. Today's actually my last day as a state fish and wildlife biologist, so I'm entering a new era here. Both Frank and I do consulting for Land and Legacy, a Missouri-based company here, small company that does habitat consulting. But my email is kylehedges44@gmail.com. So reach out with questions. I mean, we answer questions for people all the time. We're advocates. We're glad to help. We want to see improvement, even if it's someplace we'll never lay eyes on, never hunt. I don't care. If there's more birds somewhere, I'm interested in trying to, you know, help people out. So, yep, I've started a little habitat business here locally. I'll do some prescribed burning and invasive spray and some of that type of stuff as well. That'll be my next chapter to keep me busy between hunting and fishing trips. Cool.
Frank, anything you want to add to that?
No, I think Kyle covered it really well in terms of you've got to be intentional these days to create these habitats for these critters. And you know, I've still got a few years left to go, you know, with my career and with my current job. But I think in my mind and in my, at least in what I try to project, whether it's in writings or in podcasts or whatever the medium is, advocacy, and Kyle nailed it, I've kind of moved into this advocacy portion of my career. It's not just about hunting these birds. It's about creating places and places for them to live, so that whether you hunt them or not, you can enjoy them, because there is something fascinating about upland game birds that no other guild of bird has. And I think that's where I've moved into my career. And so I think Kyle and that would wrap it up pretty nicely.
Excellent. Just to kind of put a point on that, like, Kyle, from a consulting perspective, you know, what would you consult on somebody's farm in a different state, like anywhere? Like, what is the range of your expertise and knowledge?
Oh yeah, we've been from Florida to North Dakota. We've done turkey plans. You know, we in North Dakota, we were writing stuff for pheasants, huns, and sharp-tailed grouse.
Awesome.
Florida, we've done quail and deer and turkeys and all the states in between. So yeah, a lot of Land and Legacy, if you look into them, they're a deer based. That's where they started. And the two main guys, Matt and Adam, that own the company are very deer focused folks. And that's the bulk of the consults, but
yeah.
And we can do those as well. But we bring the bird aspect to Land and Legacy. So,
okay.
Yeah. No, Frank did one in Montana.
Heck yeah. Okay. Awesome. Well, I will collect contact info and grab some of those articles you mentioned on the burning for sure. We'll gather up whatever we can, drop that in the show notes for listeners. I hope some folks reach out to you if needed, and really appreciate your time, guys. Thanks for all the work that you've done. Congrats on moving on to your next chapter, Kyle. Frank, not too distant future, I'm sure you'll be doing the same. But keep up the great work, guys. And if there's anything we can help you with on the podcast, you know how to get a hold of me.
Thanks, Nick.
Really appreciate it, Nick.
Appreciate it a lot.
All right, guys, that does it for this episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Hey, everyone, it's your host, Nick, here with one more thing before you go. I want to thank you for joining us for this episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt. Be sure to subscribe and follow the show so you don't miss our next episode. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can do so by joining our Patreon community. Click the link in the show notes of this episode to learn more. You can sign up for as little as $5 a month. And if you do, I'll send you some of these Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers as a thank you from me. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.